what we've seen in Syria, for example, Father, and also in Iraq, is that what are considered non-conforming Muslims, those who would say we don't support the establishment of a caliphate, we reject, you know, the kind of violence you're using, I mean, they're paying with their lives. They're either part of summary executions, you know, they're dumped into mass graves, they're literally crucified in public squares as examples of non-conformists.
Every day, the news media reports more violence in the Middle East. Men, women, and children are abducted by the hundreds. Public places are bombed and people killed. Governments are overthrown. Cities are won and lost. If you find it hard to understand the reasons behind the horrific actions, we're going to pick that apart for you over the next half hour on this edition of Come Receive the Light.
I think what Christians need to do right now is protect themselves, quite honestly. The Christian population in the region, in Syria and Iraq, is at risk of complete annihilation. This kind of a group looks at Christians as second-class citizens, you know, at best, and at worst, they look at them as groups that need to be eliminated.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Come Receive the Light, a broadcast outreach of the Orthodox Christian Network. I'm Mike Trout, and our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. We look at all aspects of life through the lens of the Orthodox Christian faith and reach around the world through this radio broadcast and the Internet. Our website is myocn.net. That's myocn.net. Well, a friend recently sent me a note saying, quote, "War is a difficult subject. Death, honor, brutality, victory, horror, freedom, pride, and unspeakable grief expressed in just three letters, W-A-R. And as most of us can attest, it's even more difficult to process when we don't understand or know the reasons for the atrocities that are taking place. And that's why we invited a longtime friend to join us on today's broadcast. Dr. Elizabeth Prodromo is a visiting associate professor of conflict resolution at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and affiliate scholar at Harvard University's Center for European Studies, where she will be co-chairing the new study group on the Eastern Mediterranean and Europe. And she recently submitted an article to the Huffington Post that caught our attention, entitled "A Basketball Guide to Middle East News."
What does basketball have to do with those horrifying scenes of violence we're seeing in the Middle East?
You know, Father, I wrote that piece when I was watching the NBA playoffs, so I didn't mean to be in any way, I didn't mean to not take seriously what was happening in the region, but as I was watching the playoffs, I was thinking about, and I mentioned in the article, Johnny Most, the old Celtics announcer, who used to talk about guards who would bring the ball up the floor, and then they would fiddle and diddle, doodle and daddle, as was his fantastic expression. And, you know, people used to watch these guards dribbling, seeming to hog the ball, slow down the clock, not really have a plan, when in fact, in the language of the late, great Johnny Most, everyone knew that the best fiddlers and diddlers were these basketball guards who were actually surveying the defense, and they were waiting for just a moment of opportunity to strike, you know, reading the defense, and then, you know, a blow to the opposing team that would, you know, win the game and hopefully win a series. So these were the guys who were really floor generals, and they had an incredible sense of vision, and they knew what the end game really was. And I was thinking about ISIS, the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, also called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, your Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. We've heard all of these
things. Yeah.
ISIS has, you know, really been part of the equation in Syria for some time now, but nobody's really been paying a lot of attention to them. And, you know, they were seen as a kind of, you know, second-order player in the horrible disaster that is Syria, when in fact, if you've been watching what they're doing, they are these fiddlers and diddlers. They have been very patient, very deliberate, and never have lost sight of their end game. And that's what we're seeing now being played out, the move towards their end game. So that's from whence I backed into the discussion on the Middle East with basketballology.
Well, we hear a lot in the news, of course. You have various newscasters, some who are newscasters, some who are entertainers, actually, who take to task all of our politicians, including the president, including the Congress, for what's happening right now. They said maybe we could use this fiddle and diddle, doodle and daddle sort of thing. This was going on. Nobody saw it. So let's talk a little bit about who is ISIS and who's ISIS targeting, because this really did catch a lot of people by surprise. No one, I don't think a lot of people knew who ISIS was or even what it stood for that matter.
Right. Well, Father, again, I think the various names, so just so we know, we hear ISIS and ISIL, mm-hmm. Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, so namely all of that Eastern Mediterranean region, okay?
That's what we hear, the ISIL, correct?
Right. Okay. Or Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or al-Sham, ISIS. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is a terrorist group. They are extremists, and they have been very active on the ground throughout the Syrian conflict. They're basically an offshoot of al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was a highly publicized break between ISIS and the al-Nusra Front mm-hmm. in Syria, which is al-Qaeda's kind of local operation, back in February this year. And the al-Qaeda leadership, Ayman al-Zawahiri, disavowed ISIS and said that their tactics were too extreme, et cetera. If you can believe that, al-Qaeda is calling ISIS too extreme. Wow. That was the proximate cause of that rupture. But in fact, what was really at issue here was a kind of operational and strategic disagreement. And ISIS's view, again, has been to move very deliberately and relatively quickly, if anybody has been watching, in terms of consolidating its hold over the Syrian opposition to the al-Assad regime in Syria, and ultimately keeping its eye on this end game of moving back towards Baghdad, recapturing territories in Iraq, and ultimately reestablishing an Islamic caliphate in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people who have been watching the situation on the ground in Syria have been very, very concerned about the ability of ISIS to consolidate its control over the opposition in Syria, which has meant that moderate Sunni Muslims in Syria in the opposition have been, you know, largely marginalized and terrorized, quite literally, into submission to ISIS or al-Nusra's objectives.
Another question I have, we hear this word caliphate many, many times in the news. Can you explain to us what that is?
Sure. The caliphate is basically, it's an Islamic state that's led by a supreme religious leader mm-hmm. Who also has political power. That's the caliph. We sometimes hear in the Ottoman context, we hear about the sultanate or the caliphate.
Okay.
But basically, a caliphate is a way of organizing society according to the strictest interpretation of Sharia Islamic law, so that society is organized as a theocracy. Politics and society are organized around a theocratic model. And throughout history, where we've seen, you know, Muslim empires come to fruition, they've been organized as caliphates.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that the whole, you know, Muslim community of the faithful, called the Ummah, are ruled, ruled by a single caliph. That caliphate, that form of organization, is supposed to be loyal to the original caliphate or the constitution that was established at Medina by the Muslim prophet Muhammad.
Okay, good. Now, if we go back to the analogy of the basketball, let's look at that for a minute. What does it mean then to sort of win the game in their eyes? What are they after here?
Well, so what they are after then is reestablishing a caliphate at Baghdad. And Baghdad's very important, Father Chris, because Baghdad was the site of one of the most successful Islamic caliphates in history under the Abbasid dynasty, excuse me. The first caliphate, the other very successful caliphate, was actually established, again, these places are important for us, in Damascus under the Umayyad dynasty. So the end game for ISIS is to first reestablish a caliphate, and then to grow the caliphate outward. And what does that actually mean? It means that, you know, the kind of borders and boundaries and the way we organize our world today, states, become irrelevant, because they're talking about a transnational, you know, religious, political way of organizing the world. That's why they talk about Iraq and Syria, because these are the historic sites of, you know, the most powerful caliphates in history. And notice the borders, you know, begin to be irrelevant. So state borders fall away. That's the, you know, immediate, you know, goal. And then some would argue, you know, security analysts and others would argue that the objective is a global caliphate. Now, I mean, that's, you know, that's a huge jump, but nonetheless, you know, in the eyes of some of these actors, that might indeed be the case. And that's and that would be established through not only growing control over countries that have Muslim majority populations, but then using jihad or holy war to establish a global caliphate.
Now, is there, in your studies, because obviously you're the expert here, I'm not the expert, I'm just asking the questions, if we look at this from, I guess, the Christian standpoint, which always says, turn the other cheek, negotiate with the person, work with the person. I mean, are these people that can be worked with, or are these people, I mean, how do you deal with this type of a threat at this point? Because they believe that they're correct in establishing this theocratic state, which they believe is the right way to do it. And these people are willing to die because in martyrdom they go to heaven and they have all kinds of joys there, as we know. So, I mean, are we able to deal with these people? Are we able to compromise with these people? What are we going to do?
Father Chris, that's a great question. If I had the answer, I don't know. The world might be a different place if any of us had that answer. But I guess a couple of things. First of all, I think it's important for us to recognize, you know, kind of facts on the ground, and that's that although there has been support for, more recently, for ISIS or either the al-Nusra Front or even al-Qaeda, okay, the fact of the matter is, if we look at ISIS in particular, the short-term success of ISIS, both in Syria and now in Iraq, has grown out of a set of conditions of, you know, anger and resentment by Sunni majority Muslims who feel that they have been marginalized and pushed to the side in Syria by the Alawite regime, which is a minority regime of the al-Assad family, and then in Iraq since 2003 in the U.S. invasion, there was a purging of the Iraqi military, the Ba'athist military, which meant that pretty much all Sunnis lost their positions in the military and the civil service, and we saw this, you know, government, a Shiite minority government of al-Maliki, come to power. So I mention that because although there seems to be short-term support or, you know, kind of opportunistic support for ISIS, that's, I would say, largely an expression of anger and resentment and hostility at governments that have dealt very poorly with Sunni populations. And that's important, again, because it means that the traction for these kinds of groups is probably not very deep. But what from, you say, from the Christian perspective and also from the U.S. perspective, what to do? I mean, there can't be missteps. And I think, you know, that means using force to try to resolve the issue, I think, is a formula for disaster. After all, using force is partly what created some of the conditions that allowed this group to gain traction, 2003 to the present in Iraq. And to recognize that there are deep-seated economic and political reasons that these kinds of groups are able to attract followers.
Right.
And I think what certainly we as Christians have to do is, I think what Christians need to do right now is protect themselves, quite honestly. Okay. The Christian population in the region, in Syria and Iraq, is at risk of complete annihilation. This kind of a group looks at Christians as dhimmi, as second-class citizens, you know, at best, and at worst, they look at them as, you know, basically, you know, groups that need to be eliminated.
Okay.
So I think it's really incumbent upon all Christians to recognize that, you know, Christians in the region are at risk of elimination. And if that means, and it does mean, you know, finding ways to provide humanitarian support for them, both in country but also as refugees, that's something that we can do. I mean, there are huge, massive outflows of Christian refugees from Syria and now again for the second time in a decade out of Iraq, and they're largely going to Jordan and to Lebanon, and those two countries are ill-equipped to deal with the massive refugee flows. So we can do a lot as Christians to help provide humanitarian assistance. And then over the longer term, I think, you know, we need to think, if the U.S. is thinking about its foreign policy, I mean, recognize that economic development assistance is critical rather than military assistance. You know, how many billions of dollars in military assistance have gone to governments in the region that are, they're corrupt and they're incompetent and they disenfranchise their own people and they create the very conditions for these kinds of groups to take root.
Yes.
So we need to be far more judicious and prudent in the way in which, you know, we use our foreign assistance.
I've heard about ISIS in relation to Syria and now Iraq in the news. But you also talk about Turkey in your article. Can you give us a reason why?
Sure, Father. I mentioned Turkey for several reasons. First of all, as a NATO ally, Turkey throughout the conflict in Syria has allowed ISIS to, first of all, take aid and comfort in southern Turkey. I mean, anyone watching what was going on in Syria knew that ISIS was operating with a pretty free hand and was, you know, basically crossing the Syrian border with Turkey and, you know, kind of recharging their batteries and then moving back into Syria. So Turkey has been unhelpful in that regard, and they're not the only ones. I mean, the Saudis and the Qataris have been providing funding and arms to ISIS for a while. But, I mean, Turkey's right on the border, number one. Number two, Turkey has also allowed ISIS to, you know, produce a very large income stream for itself by transporting oil out of ISIS-controlled territories through Turkey. I also mentioned Turkey because Turkey is now asking for U.S. assistance to provide for refugees from Syria and Iraq. And I think, you know, again, from a U.S. foreign policy perspective and, you know, the NATO alliance, it's absolutely crucial that, you know, that kind of assistance be provided with qualifications that, you know, if you're looking for this kind of support, then, you know, you need to make sure that you're not part of the problem when it comes to looking the other way for providing, you know, operational and revenue support to ISIS. And then I also mentioned Turkey for another reason, and that's that, interestingly enough, in terms of this whole discussion about the caliphate, last week Turkey's two, you know, main opposition parties to the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, announced that their joint candidate for presidential elections in August is going to be Ekmeleddin İhsanoğlu, and he is the just finished 10 years total terms as the chief of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And why is that important? Well, it's interesting, first of all, that the CHP, which is the inheritor party from Kemal, and the MHP, which is the Nationalist Action Party, they're a fascist party. The two of them are basically throwing their support behind an Islamist as an opposition candidate to the Prime Minister Erdogan. And an Islamist who's been very successful as the head of the global 57-member state Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And that's an organization that's kind of flown under the radar. I mean, they're after the UN, they're the second largest international organization in the world.
Say that name again, please. I want people to hear that name because I don't think many people know about this. Say who this group is again, please.
Okay, so their acronym is the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and they're, as I mentioned, they're, you know, the second largest international organization in the world after the UN, and they have a very extensive charter, global network of organizations that do everything from refugee relief to education. But what's interesting about their charter is that on the face of it, they say that, you know, they support the United Nations and the work of the United Nations. But if you drill down a little more deeply, you see that throughout their charter, they qualify their commitment to international law, basically through the UN, according to compatibility with Sharia.
Okay.
So there's real kind of question about, you know, how you can balance a commitment to Sharia, which in many ways stands really in contradistinction to universal human rights and other dimensions of international law. And İhsan Oğlu, the Turkish academic and diplomat, has had for 10 years, he finished his term December 2013, he had been the very successful leader of the OIC. He really raised the profile, the global profile of the OIC. So he's now the opposition candidate to Erdogan. So you have this interesting kind of Islamist game now being played out in Turkey between, you know, a more hardline Egyptian Brotherhood style mm-hmm. candidate who is the prime minister of Turkey. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey is the governing party in Turkey. And then this alternate candidate who also, you know, has been a leader of a global Islamic organization who, you know, it's kind of questionable sort of which way the wind will blow in terms of this other, you know, game of moderate versus radical Islamist forces in the region. So that's why I introduced Turkey, Father.
Okay, very good. It's a fascinating conversation with you. I have one more question for you. Who or what can stop ISIS, do you think?
I don't know who or what can fully stop ISIS, but ISIS is an extremist group. They're a terrorist group, and mm-hmm. they operate in the name of religion. So I think those who must most immediately stand up and oppose the kind of positions that that group take are Muslims themselves. I mean, they're operating in the name of Islam. So it's up to Muslims who, you know, believe that, you know, the use of violence, the way ISIS is using violence in order to achieve goals that they say are Islamic, it's Muslims who have to stand up and say, we in no way condone this.
And frankly, I don't hear that.
I think what's happening in the region, Father, is that, you know, Muslim populations themselves are terrified mm-hmm. by this group.
Probably.
I mean, there's a difference between civilian populations and governments. I think, you know, what we've seen in Syria, for example, Father, and also in Iraq, is that what are considered non-conforming Muslims, those who would say we don't support the establishment of a caliphate, we reject, you know, the kind of violence you're using, I mean, they're paying, and ISIS puts this stuff, you know, out on the web. I mean, they're paying with their lives. They're either part of summary executions, you know, they're dumped into mass graves, they're crucified, they're literally crucified in public squares as examples of nonconformists. So there's, you know, fear on the ground. And then, you know, the other big problem in the region, Father, as you say, you know, not hearing kind of opposition, is that, you know, Muslim-majority governments like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, I mean, these guys were wink, wink, nod, nod, mm-hmm. nod, nod, you know, supporting ISIS as a way to get rid of the al-Assad regime. But, you know, their hour is upon them because groups like ISIS consider the Saudis, the Qataris, pretty much everyone, you know, the Egyptians, even under the Brotherhood, they consider them as corrupt. So, you know, they consider those as regimes that need to be, you know, done away with as well because they consider them having betrayed true Islam. So the ball's really, to go back to sports, the ball's really in the court of, you know, Muslim-majority governments and populations. But then in terms of U.S. and foreign assistance, it's critical to stop supporting, you know, blindly authoritarian secularist regimes who say, oh, support us because we're not, you know, we don't support, you know, kind of a Sharia state.
Okay.
And then also to, you know, find ways to provide economic development assistance so that people don't turn to extremism out of, you know, anger, frustration, and, you know, resentment.
You and I attended a conference in Washington, D.C. a little while ago dealing with the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. And we heard Metropolitan Methodius, the Greek Orthodox Metropolitan or Bishop Hierarch of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese there in the Boston area. And he said something that he saw in the airport. If you see something, say something. It was about the security issues, correct? And,
yeah.
And I would say to you and to our listeners that now's the time for people to speak up. We saw Pope Francis and we saw Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew together in Jerusalem. They prayed together at the Holy Sepulchre. They represent 1.5 billion Christians worldwide, which, to the best of my mathematical calculations, is 20% of the world's population. So if the Christians begin to speak up, and the so-called moderate Muslims, who frankly right now are completely silent, Now, I can understand why the ones in the Middle East are silent, because fear of threat of their families being destroyed, their families, their homes are annihilated. We understand that. But what about Muslims around the world who are not living under that? Why are they silent? So I would say to our listeners, if you see something, and clearly we're seeing something, it's about time people started saying something to save this situation. And let's, I guess the governments are going to have to deal with people like this who feel they have to annihilate other people in order to live their lives. I don't see why we can't live in peace. When we came over and our ancestors came over here, Elizabeth, to the country, Germans, Greeks, Poles, Italians, Russians, they all lived together. There was never a problem. And maybe now the world just has too much. When we had less, it seemed that we were more at peace. I don't know. But that's, I guess, my ranting at the end of our conversation. Elizabeth, it's always an honor to have you on the program. We thank you for your contribution and clearly for your knowledge, and pray for your continued success in everything you do.
Thank you, Father Chris. And congratulations to OCN for all the incredible work that you do, because, I mean, visiting the website, listening to your programming, you guys just do, you know, regular sterling work, and it's really, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on, and it's also, you know, a pleasure to support you in every way possible, Father.
Thank you, Elizabeth. God bless.
How nice to get those kind words from Elizabeth Prodromo, and I know we'll hear from her in the future. She's been a regular guest on Come Receive the Light, and a very important ingredient in our outreach at the Orthodox Christian Network, where we can be found on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. If you'd like to listen to this broadcast again or share it with someone else, just encourage them, or you go to our website at myocn.net and click on the Listen link and then select Come Receive the Light. That's myocn.net. Well, we provide resources that are geared to help you worship Christ and grow in your relationship with Him in a variety of ways. We do that through our internet-only radio stations featuring music and talk, our blog posts on The Sounding. Those are updated regularly, and you'll find some great thought-provoking features right there. That's The Sounding. Our Facebook presence. By the way, if you haven't liked us on Facebook, please do so. We're getting close to the 200,000 like mark, and you might be the one to help us pass that milestone. Plus, all of the podcasts that are available from contributors around the world, the latest of which is a podcast that focuses on married saints and features Dr. David Ford.
This is going to be a great series, David, and I'm very pleased that you're doing it. Tell us a little bit about what we're starting today, what you're hoping to cover, and what you would like our listeners to take away from it, because that's really important.
Well, my main hope and prayer would be that our listeners would, through coming to know specifically some of the great married saints, that their fellowship with the saints would become more and more meaningful, especially as we get to know them. So the first one in our series is going to be St. Elizabeth, died in Russia in 1918. Then for August, Saints Adrian and Natalia, early martyrs. In September, St. Angelis, the goldsmith and father of six children, who died at the hands of the Ottoman Turks in Constantinople in 1680. And then for October, Saints Andronicus and Athanasia, 6th century Antioch. November, Saints Justinian and Theodora, Empress and Emperor of the Byzantine Empire in the 6th century. Great example of teamwork in marriage. December, Saints Stephen and Angelina of Serbia. January, St. Xenophon and Mary. In February, two of my favorites, Saints Priscilla and Aquila, a husband and wife missionary team in the early church. They're mentioned six times in the New Testament. Then March, St. Innocent, apostle to America, great missionary in the 19th century to Alaska. Then in April, St. Argiri, who also suffered under the Ottoman Turks. In May, Saints Richtrud and Adalbald from 7th century France. And then in June, Saint Sophia, became mother to something like 100 orphans after her husband and all her children died. So
sounds like an incredible series, Doctor.
Well, I'm excited about it, and I hope it will be helpful for many.
My goodness, he has the whole year planned out. That's Dr. David Ford, and a brand new podcast available on our website at myocn.net. Again, just click on the Listen button and then select Podcasts, and you'll find that it's already started with Dr. Ford. I'm Mike Trout. Our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. This is a weekly broadcast called Come Receive the Light, and special thanks, as always, to our executive producer and anchored. Let your friends know about the program. Encourage them to listen. Pray for the ministry. And if you can, consider supporting this work. We're a nonprofit outreach and depend upon your generosity. You can give securely when you go to that website, myocn.net. And remember to always have faith in what you listen to.